Hello and welcome to Spotlight On. I'm your host, Lawrence Purrier. Spotlight On is brought to you by Lyte, the technology platform reimagining e-commerce for live events. You can learn more about Lyte at lyte.com/partnerships. That's lyte.com/partnerships. Today, the spotlight is on John Rosso. John is my longtime friend and colleague, and he's currently Senior Vice President of Client Services at the Harry Fox Agency. He started his career at SST Records, with stops at Atlantic Records, Live Nation, and more along the way. John also hosts This Music Hour on Radio Free Brooklyn, where he explores a different musical theme each week. As you will see, our shared level of music nerddom makes him the ideal host for that format. You're about to spend some time with a couple of longtime friends and music geeks. Buckle up and have fun. Hello?
We got it.
Really? You can hear me?
I can hear you. I think what happened is I plugged in my board while Zoom was already launched, and so it didn't recognize it.
I call that a Zoom error. I don't think that's your fault.
Well, it's my Mac. It's probably my Mac not recognizing that this was anyway, whatever. We're here.
Before you couldn't hear me, I was saying, "Wow, that's a very professional setup you have," but now I realize it's a piece of shit.
Hopefully I sound better than plugging in my AirPods or whatever you call them.
You do have a rich baritone.
Thank you. And I got the compression cranked, you know. So nice.
I don't like to make any assumptions for listeners, right? So can you tell people what Harry Fox Agency does? Let's start there.
Sure. Happy to do that. Are we starting now?
Oh, yeah, we're starting. Okay. We'll edit out the beginning, but yeah, we're starting now.
Okay. I didn't realize that was an actual question. But
yeah, it's cool. We go right in.
So the Harry Fox Agency is about 95 years old, started in 1921. Well, actually, no, 1927. So we have another 6 years. And it was founded by actually someone named Harry Fox.
And no longer with us?
No, died in the 60s.
Okay.
One of the mysteries of the Harry Fox Agency is that we cannot find a picture of Harry. And then people all the time send us a picture of Harry Fox, the vaudevillian, not the same Harry Fox, but people send that picture all the time.
That's amazing.
So was hoping to have a picture on our wall that said our founder. But so it's the original U.S. Mechanical Licensing Agency. Mechanical licenses being a music royalty publishing use. It's literally, at the time, it was for the mechanical reproduction of a song. So if you pressed a piano roll at the time, or a piece of shellac at the time, and you know, eventually vinyl and cassettes and now downloads and streaming, that reproduction of the composition itself is a copyright that anybody who makes one of those things and distributes them has to pay a U.S. statutory rate. Currently, of 9.1 cents is the current rate. There's a lot of debate going on. That rate has not changed in a long time. But it also spent like decades at like 1 cent. So there was a huge jump to 9 cents, but now obviously people are itching for that to go up. And that's for downloads. That's for your, you know, everything. And so the Harry Fox Agency, represents music. It was actually at one point owned by the National Music Publishers Association. And, with that, they said, "Oh, you need a record label. You need a license to do this. Send a letter to Harry." And literally it was the Harry Fox Agency, and everyone would register whatever songs they had written, and the record label would get their license through the Harry Fox Agency. And then every quarter they'd have to pay their royalties. There's a lot more to that. Obviously rates are different with streaming now. And, but historically that's where it was, you know. The quick modernization of that was, mm-hmm. right? So Warner owns a publishing industry, a company, Warner Chappell, and they also own Warner Brothers Records and whatever. So they no longer go through the Harry Fox agency, because it's essentially an intercompany exchange. So that kind of started evolving the business. And then with streaming, you now had companies like Spotify and Apple and Amazon creating these streaming services, and yet they were that was the law requires them to get that license, but they obviously license the sound recordings they're using themselves, so that as they get farther away from the knowledge of what song called Angel it is, they in turn had to rely on companies like the Harry Fox agency. It's like, hey, we have this thing, it's performed by this artist, and it's this song called Angel. And we're like, oh, well, we actually licensed the original recording on Warner Brothers from that artist. And so we know it's this composition written by this person. We could connect you to the publisher, and then we would issue a license that way. And then ultimately there was a competitor called Music Reports that came out did the same service for other competing digital services. And then the big blow up that happened in the last couple of years, there was the signing of this thing called the Music Modernization Act, which was the first real upgrade to copyright since the 1976 Act. And that created this thing called the Mechanical Licensing Collective. People lovingly call it the MLC, which started just in January of this year. And they are handling all of the streaming services and the downloads for mechanical licenses, essentially moving it away from these individual companies, Music Reports and the Harry Fox agency. So it's sort of a, I don't even want to call it quasi-governmental, but as a result, there is now this independent group run really by the music publishers that all of those streaming services report their streaming mechanical royalties into this company, and then they do the match. So all the money sits there, and there's a ton of rules around it or whatever, but essentially that's been sort of the evolution of the mechanical license, and really the central piece of what the Harry Fox agency has done for 94 years now.
So with the advent of the MLC and with the consolidation of so much publishing into the major label groups, what's that meant for your business?
So it's just, we've evolved. I mean, really, so historically our only business was, we were owned by the NMPA, the National Music Publishers Association, and was essentially their administration arm. As a result of that, everyone came to us for a mechanical license. Like, that's separate from ASCAP, BMI, CSAC. That's the performance side. And people confuse us, but we were the only people doing mechanicals. So mechanicals became, so the first evolution where we had to adapt was, these companies getting bigger and doing that business a lot more direct. That essentially, you know, shrunk our business, but it was just sort of the expectation. It was a better process for the people that essentially owned us. Then the big change came with digital and streaming, and that they started using something called the notice of intent, because a mechanical license, I'm sorry, I'm going to sound like a lawyer too much here, but you can't tell someone they can't cover your song. Once right. Someone records a song, you anybody could do a cover. And as a result, they call it a compulsory notice. And so you could actually then serve a letter to someone and have to follow all the obligations that are established in the Copyright Act. It's like, you have to report every month. You have to send a note, the notice at a certain time. A lot of hoops to jump through. And so that became the growth of these companies like Music Reports. And there was another company that got bought by Google called RightsFlow. And as a result, HFA then got into that business too. We only used to work on the publisher side of the business. So HFA, as it's called, we then centralized, and really our first client was the probably iteration 4 of Napster, which is now, you know, Napster is now the name, the brand that the Rhapsody streaming service uses. But at one point it was owned by BMG, and it moved around the brand. Best Buy owned it for a while.
Yeah.
And so we kind of worked with several of those iterations. And so we ended up filling the gap of not doing the mechanical publishing, by working on the side of the people who needed licenses but had no idea how to get them. So we became much more the racetrack as opposed to a horse, right? We used to work for the stable, then we now working for the the fans, and then now we're just the racetrack, and we're sort of on both sides of it. And then the MLC kind of took the fan side of it away. So we aren't really working for the DSPs at this point. But the interesting piece is, so the MLC needed a technological and a database support to do it. So we're now a vendor to the MLC to essentially do what we were doing independently as a support process for the MLC, which is now funded by all of these DSPs. So it's a bit of a, for us, it's been an interesting change. We've essentially sat in the same place, and the business has changed around us, and we've just had relationships with different players in it.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So that's always been, and I should tell you, the other piece that we've adapted on is now we don't do just mechanical rights anymore. So we do, we do clearances for karaoke services and jukeboxes, and we even do performance administration that, some people do direct deals and withdraw their rights from ASCAP or BMI, but they still need someone to do the administration royalties. So it's interesting. We've actually moved from pretty much a pure publishing side, and we audited record labels to make sure they were paying their royalties, to now we built essentially the database of record that is now being used by the Mechanical Licensing Collective and being expanded on there. And we still continue to, in the end of the day, it's been our relationships and just our basic knowledge of how all the moving parts work. And as you could hear, it's so legalistic, just having that depth and knowledge of how you do it legally has been our greatest value. So
when you were owned by the publishers, was Harry Fox a nonprofit or what was the legal structure or the corporate structure versus what it is now? Are you a for-profit entity?
So I should, the one piece we're missing here. So in 2015, we were bought by the Harry Fox Agency was bought by the CSAC Music Group,
okay,
which also owns the CSAC Performing Group. They also own a company called Mint, which is a joint venture for international royalties. So essentially, this CSAC Music Group is essentially putting all the pieces together of music publishing so that a company could do an a la carte or an all in where they could continue to focus on the creative side. And then all of that backroom stuff, you don't need a big infrastructure, but anyway, so the historic piece was the NMPA was funded by the profits of the Harry Fox Agency. So there wasn't, so if you had to become a member of the National Publishers Association in order to benefit from all their lobbying, well, directly, I should say, they would do settlements and stuff too. But and so HFA had a running budget, and anything above the budget was what funded the NMPAs, mostly, legal fund. And so, so we had we would every year go and we need to increase our budget or do. So it was kind of one of the interesting challenges in that model was the people that are getting the benefit of the service wanted to be as inexpensive as possible, but they also control the purse strings of how you were going to get better. You needed to do the investment too. So that was always kind of interesting. And in fact, until around 2001, somewhere around there, 2000, the head of the NMPA and the head of the Harry Fox Agency were the same person. And one of the beginnings of the real modernization of the Harry Fox Agency is they created a lobbyist, the president of the NMPA, who I think is almost that entire time really has been David Israelite, and then a CEO for the Harry Fox Agency, which the first one was Gary Churgin, and now it's the second one, the current one is Michael Simon. And so they've actually truly divided it into an operations group and a lobbying group, and the two used to be the same. So that's where that's evolved. And now it's a for-profit, which has actually been, we're now an actual competitive group because people invest, we have an investor that, or I shouldn't say, we have an owner with cash that we don't have to, that we actually make a legitimate business request as opposed to, begging from the people who are also our customers.
Yeah, that's not the funnest dynamic. And so what do you do there?
So, so my role is I'm my title is senior vice president of client relations or publisher services, and essentially anything sort of external with the company rolls up to me. So with that, I have a team of publisher agents, and their role is to answer questions for music publishers who I need to get my songs registered. Really, the question always comes down to is where is my money? Right. That's yeah. It's sort of in it. And it could be a data issue. It could be a matching issue. It could be you haven't registered that song, or we didn't have this information and now we could, or the someone's not reporting and we have to go after them. Then there's also a licensing team, and the licensing team is they get requests from record labels or digital services saying I'm seeking a license for this sound recording I have that I'm distributing. And it's this composition, issue a license to me. And then the third group is the more sort of the more contemporary department, which is our client relation managers, our CRMs, and they're the ones that work with the different DSPs who now, hey, the Harry Fox agency has this information and knowledge and we need to obtain the rights. And that might be through a traditional mechanical license, but more common now is a direct license where they've sought out and gotten certain rights to use the catalogs of the major publishers and then a lot of the big publishers. And through the Harry Fox agency, you could opt in smaller publishers too, that we, so it's a little beyond just, I'm going to reproduce a song. Now it's I have an exercise app, and it's going to be in synchronization with these workouts. And so it goes beyond what the compulsory would allow. Mm-hmm. So you now actually have to negotiate terms and rates, and there's usually a rev share. And so our team essentially oversees that, okay, you're using this music and we're putting it through our system, and we're going to tell you, okay, we were able to find and get you licenses for these. So these are the ones that are available to your service. And then they report royalties.
In the time you've been at HFA, never mind the time you've been in the music business overall, but just in the time you've been at HFA, is it generally true that music is used in more ways than ever before?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's pretty funny. You know, as you were around when it was all of a sudden, people were freaking out. It's like music, you know, the model's changing. It's the whole Move My Cheese thing where music is free now and it's cheaper and whatever. And it was just a matter of figuring out how to monetize it. And now that's just been coming back in such a huge way. So absolutely. I mean, the early movers were right. The people, well, we're just going to go and do it. And then when it gets really popular, we'll negotiate, you know, because everyone's going to keep that. So that was, you know, the big gorilla in that is, you know, is probably first a Napster who got beaten up, but then a YouTube comes along, and you know, you have the Google power and the lawyers and everything. And so now that model doesn't work anymore, where I'm gonna use it now, sue me later, and we'll
steal my way to legitimacy.
Exactly. So now people, you know, are there's the smaller companies with any legitimacy, you know, start off with a conversation with us, actually. You know, they go, it's like, oh, we just made a deal with so and so, and now they told us we have to get publishing licenses. Can you tell us what that is? And you know, and as the audience gets more sophisticated, it becomes easier too. But yeah, music is everywhere.
Has it gotten easier in the last, pick an interval, 5 years, 7 years, for a new user of music, like a technology upstart, to get licensed? Because I remember going 5 to 10 years, there were so many entrants and it was too hard for all of the, especially corporate stakeholders, to figure out who to do business with and who not to. Has that problem been solved at all?
I mean, not solved, but it's certainly a lot easier, right? I think to your point, that was, you know, as where the money goes is kind of what drives the business. And it became, ooh, music is too scary because people get sued and you know, we can't get clearances. We don't want all of a sudden to be shut down because of this, right? Even though we have this great product demand, being able to use it without the, you know, compensating the creators was a problem. And I think as a result, that started the conversations, which now have mostly been resolved. Like there is, you know, the consolidation to a certain extent makes that process a little easier. Okay, I have to go have a conversation with the big three. And usually the first one of the big three in who gets the negotiation, all the models then are identical or close to that, and you find it out, and then that gets dropped into. So we have this thing called the agreement portal, and it's we'll literally drop in. Hey, we've just so and so has just come to us with this app. It does this. It does these other things. It's looking for these rights, for this terms, for this rate. Do you want to participate? Yes or no. And 99% of the time, people are going to say yes because it's like their job is to. I'm trying to monetize my revenue or my copyrights, and so that kind of right. So the And usually that first agreement that gets dropped into our portal doesn't exist until there is a big negotiation where someone brings on the first mover that everyone lines up behind, right? Gotcha. So as a result, that happens. So the fact that those conversations are being had, I mean, you remember in our days, we used to go and try to beg people. It's like about doing custom compilations, and it's like you'd get, maybe they would go talk to the special markets people. You know, you might be able to get some the same stuff that you see at road stops on those cassettes, you know, back in the 70s and 80s for your company. And now that the walls are broken down because it's the primary source of recorded revenue is that. So obviously, you know, once again, the labels, the publishers are the same entity in a lot of cases too. So it's moved quickly, but yeah 10 years ago, really hard. Last 4 or 5 years, accelerating. There's just too many deals for us to even talk to.
And in that same period of time, what's been the evolution of the state of metadata? Is it still the thorn in everybody's side, or has that been improved upon?
It's still a thorn, but it has moved greatly. And I think this is going to be the big mover with the MLC. The MLC essentially now has made a public database, and the law that was passed requires the visibility of so much more. And so one of the challenges in the past was you only have so much visibility because essentially it became, okay, I can now go look in this database and see that my song is getting used here. So now I could go sue these people, or I could go, you know, and it became, there was a world of litigation that was driving the marketplace. And rather than how can I make this more efficient? There was more money in litigation than there was in your number of streams, you know, so that, you know, the classic model, right? It's always follow the money. So now it's the fact that now everyone can see what copyrights they have registered, who controls them, what sound recordings are matched to them, all of that stuff, all of those tools are now being built out of the MLC. Anybody now could go to the MLC.com and search and find any song. And to a certain extent of who controls it. So I think it's one of those classic, the more sunshine on it, you could, it's almost like the people talked about how blockchain was going to be, okay, everyone's going to see it and it's going to have this. Now it's just going to be out in the open. If there is a bad claim, people will see who the person is claiming it that's making the bad claim, you know? So there'll be a lot of self-policing and that. So I, if anything else, I think that's going to be, we're going to have the opposite problem. There's going to be probably more conflicts because things that people didn't know were in conflict are going to be a lot more visible.
Oh, wow. And then does that process play itself out to at some point, all that's left are some remaining border skirmishes, but the right thing finally happens and like equilibrium is established?
Yeah, I think so. I really do. I actually, and to a certain extent, the complexities of deals, I think, are going to get simpler because at this point, right, a publisher frequently represents a territory and in some cases limited rights because it's almost like, okay, I wrote a song, I've owned these, and now I'm going to sell it out. You know, I'm going to sell out a piece of the pie all over the place of who works this and who works that. And then it just becomes too complicated because then now, okay, I have my performing rights database, I have a mechanical database, I have my sync rights database, I have lyric rights, I have, right? So, and it's different in England than it is in Japan and the United States. So I think we're moving in a much more global, centralized. So the less complicated you keep it, the more likely the revenue will come in. But of course, you know, and that will be the evolution. I think administration will drive the cleaning of the data. I mean, just in the past year, it's been amazing how much more data we've gotten delivered to us since people now know that, like, the market just knows a lot better of, oh, I have to make sure my songs are in this database. Where in the past it would be like, how come so-and-so is not paying me? It's like, well, 'cause how do they find you? Like you haven't, it's like, well, my publisher, ASCAP, well, you know, actually ASCAP's not your publisher. That's your performing rights. They collect your performing rights. Who's collecting your mechanical? Who's like, how are you getting your YouTube money? And so this goes back to ultimately what we're trying to put together is the solution with the CSAC Music Group is you come to us and all of those things are available to you. Like if it could be global, it could be local, it could be YouTube only, it could be mechanical only, it could be performance through CSAC. It could be right. So all of those things used to be, I had to find a person to do that for, or someone at a big publishing company took over your publishing, but now we're in a DIY market. So, you know,
yeah.
Not a lot of knowledge there.
So just to be clear, who in the value chain, or if it's more than one stakeholder, like who is primarily doing the cleanup of the metadata? Is it the content creator or the rights holder? Is what you're saying is it's ultimately the person who's getting the biggest chunk of the money is taking the biggest initiative to clean it?
I think you've really hit on what the big issue is, right? It's who's responsible for it. And that's been part of the argument is, well, and all of these arguments I think make sense to me is, well, you're using it. So you have to find me. You're making all the money from it and you need to pay me. And historically the Harry Fox agency, right? They like of that 9 cents that would come in, the Harry Fox agency would take a commission off of it to pay for those administrations, right? That was what our call, right? So essentially that's coming out of the publisher side, right? So out of the publisher's money, they had to pay for the administration of the, so now with the MLC, the Mechanical Licensing Collective, the DSPs, that was part of the negotiation. They got some risk relief from not being sued by everybody because they licensed this entire record catalog. It's up there, but you know, someone's share is missing or they don't know who the publishing is. And as a result, you know, technically shouldn't be available on the site, but was. And historically, record companies all the time put out records having not cleared the publishing. And so as a result, now the DSPs have funded the Mechanical Licensing Collective. So they're paying for it. However, the motto of the MLC is, you know, do your part, because still at the same time, you have to register. Your songs aren't going to just magically get in there. And there is a frustration of, well, I put the title and I put my name on it. It's like, well, you also have a co-writer. So now in the database, we have Angel written by John and Angel written by Larry, when there only should be one Angel co-written by Larry and John. Right. So, and it's sort of like, okay, I get you didn't know that. And okay, so I'm going to put in there. And then the other problem is, okay, I'm going to put an Angel written by Larry and John, and I'm claiming 100% of it because, you know, that's what I think I control. Well, Larry doesn't think that. So Larry, you need to make sure you get in there and you go, and when it's like, oh, that's right. Oh, I thought I was collecting your publishing for you, Larry. Huh. Okay, well, we'll make it 50-50. That's fine. You know, it's there. Everyone has to be sort of responsible for it. And so that's where it becomes the classic old, I'm going to negotiate for complete artistic control. Well, with that comes responsibility, right? You can't just simply, it's like now you're responsible for you. I'm a self-published artist. I now need to know how to be a publisher, right? There is a value in that expertise and the money they take. It's not just a, hey, I got them to write me a big check. No, you can, they do something for that. And so that this has been the sticky piece. And so as a result, companies have grown out of this business for the DIY market. As you know, people always start up businesses chasing that DIY dollar. Oh, I'm gonna be famous, right? So there becomes that the ambition is ahead of the knowledge. So you're you know, right? It's like the end of the day. Yeah, but which is great. I mean, that's what drives everything. It's almost like, right, the best entrepreneurs aren't smart enough to be scared sometimes, and they're the ones that are most successful. But there's companies out there. There's companies like Audium. There's companies like SongTrust. There's companies like on a like a bigger scale. You can't just walk in. Like Cobalt essentially kind of works that way too, where they don't own copyrights. They provide administrative services. And the Harry Fox Agency itself kind of works that way too. Except we're, as I said, we're not three 60 where as far as doing all of that stuff, but we're, but you could essentially we're putting those pieces together. I'm trying to think if there's any other players out there, but there's that, you know, even TuneCore, DistroKid, I think offers, I think the Orchard also offers publishing administration, but from the, most people start off as I'm going to make a record. I'm going to make a recording. And then, oh, what's this publishing piece that I wrote a song? And that becomes, I'm sorry, I could keep going all day, but now it's like, hey, why are you trying to claim that song? That's my version of that Rolling Stones song. It's like, well, they own the composition that you covered. So you have no publishing on this, you know? So there's, so you hit those obstacles all the time. So,
yeah, that's funny.
Yeah.
All right. So what was your first gig in music?
I'm trying to define what my very first gig in music would be. I outside of like DIY stuff, my first gig was working. I moved to LA and I answered an ad and became the publicist for SST Records. So it was kind of a cool way. I knew what SST was, but the fact that I was now like my boss was Greg Ginn from Black Flag was pretty damn cool. And so that was sort of a bit of a baptism by fire of like it was great to be a publicist where writers loved all the bands on that label.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? What qualified you to be the publicist for SST?
You know, I still don't know. I probably was, as I went in, I had an interview and it's like, this is a well-spoken young man, unlike the dirty punks that we have here. You know, it was like, like he'll make us, you know, and you know, it was just, so we had, actually, that's not really, everyone there was, have gone on to actually very impressive music careers there. The radio promo team, the booking agents, the salespeople all ended up, you know, at Geffen and Caroline and some of the big agencies. But I just think it was my, you know, my excitement about the music and literally the fact I wasn't afraid to pick up the phone and just talk shit for a while with a writer. And just talk music. And it was like, great. Well, thanks. Send me the new records. You know,
what were some of the first records you worked?
When I got there, the Dinosaur Jr. album was kind of a little You're Living All Over Me was the record that was kind of happening that had me excited, as well as the second Screaming Trees album. Sonic Youth still had Sister, the Meat Puppets had Huevos. So it was like, oh, and Firehose Iffin. So these were all like, you know, top 10, like CMJ college radio bands. But it was an interesting time because that's when a lot of the bands started, like Husker Du had, Black Flag had broken up. D Boone from the Minutemen had the previous Christmas died in a car accident. And so Husker Du had signed to Warner. So it was kind of like, it was like the end of the big indie era, in that they were now the major labels were going to start getting interested in this. And Husker Du was kind of like, oh, this is a real credible band over there. And so one of the first bands that signed was Soundgarden. And my understanding was like Soundgarden, we were going to put out the first record, but they were already signed to A&M. Wow. So that was kind of like, no, we want our first record, our first big album to go out on an indie. And so it went on SST, and then the second album, then they kind of, it helped build their base to then go to A&M.
And what did a Soundgarden side, or if they're also in the same category, but of those artists you just mentioned and those particular records, like what were they selling back then? Was it like, how do you dimensionalize what those acts were selling?
Well, see the number. So it's funny. The thing that I was, it's like, my thought would always be, well, Sonic Youth had to be like the biggest band, but they were the biggest critics band. By far the big selling band was Black Flag, and then the Meat Puppets, like probably, you know, 2-3 times of what a Sonic Youth was doing.
But were they Sonic selling Youth, over 100 grand, or were they closer to like 20, 50?
Well, that's the thing. It's just, it's all relevant now. It's like, but I would say, you know, probably about 150,000 copies of the, you know, those new records. And then there were some more blockbusters like Double Nickels on the Dime and Zen Arcade were the big money makers for them. And what was cool is they sold everything out of their warehouse. It was like they had a bunch of indie distributors who would sell to, but like the big chains would literally be talking to like the lead singer from Nigheist, who was our head of sales, in the back room. And it was like, and I heard great stories about them having such a good time when both Zen Arcade and Double Nickels were out at the same time. And they're literally like putting the buyer from like, you know, Walmart on hold or whatever, like for 20 minutes just to torture him. But like everyone's walking in and asking for this record. I need it. And so
that was incredible.
They were very punk rock about it. But so, yeah, so those were, but now, I mean, I think that would be a number one album.
I was just going to say, yeah, when you said it's relative, like back then an indie band selling 100,000 sounds phenomenal now, but back then that was the era of, you know, a million was like, you had to sell a million to be able to put out your next record on a.
yeah, exactly. Oh, we're not going to pick up your option. It's only gold.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That's incredible. Yeah. Is there a highlight of something you worked on at that time that you're like, holy shit, man, I touched that record.
Well, I was it was the end of Sonic Youth's term with SST. So I was kind of in limbo with them when they were started working on Daydream Nation. But it was never going to be an SST record. But it was, so I ended up going to some of the rehearsal shows that they were doing for that. So I never got to deal with the finished product, but that probably like is the coolest record I got to work on or be involved with, I should say. But and then also Dinosaur's Bug was a great one too. Those are two that actually came. Most of the other great ones I worked on were in existence when I got there. Like I love that Meat Puppets Huevos record. I love the Firehose Iffin record, but they were done. And I actually got pretty friendly with the guys from Screaming Trees. So it was always good to see those guys do well. So
at that point in your life, was that your dream gig? Like, were you thinking like I'm living the dream, or like how detached from it were you, or how immersed in it were you?
I wasn't very immersed in like the hang, you know. The business part was kind of like, I was still learning what the jobs were in the business. The only thing, I mean, my sister was a music writer, is a music writer. And so I got spoiled at, you know, as knowing what backstage was when I was like 8 and 9 and, you know, going to a Kiss show and, you know, and going like, okay, I want to hang out here. You know, like this is exciting. Everyone. And it's like the whole magic that is the show. It's like, this is spectacular. And like, everyone's having a good time. And we all love this band. And, you know, all of that Almost Famous stuff was really what brought me into it. And then I slowly learned the business. I mean, the thing I like to tell people is I think I've done every job in the music business at this point. You know, I've done the publicist job. I've done radio promotion. I worked at, I booked bands. I've done obviously a lot in music publishing now. I've been a product manager at a major label. I've been in the marketing department. I've been in, you know, so it's been pretty cool. I like to think part of the reason I've survived and been successful in this business is it's also consolidated. You know how it's moved from the labels used to drive everything. Now it's very manager centric. And the best part about what I know is publishing seems to be the last great mystery. Yeah. And it really is difficult. So that's where my expertise is. And so I'm really, I know everyone's side of the business and I know this side very well. So I think I have a pretty good role in that I could talk, you know, I could get in the van and talk music publishing.
Tell me about your time at a major label. Like, I think we worked at majors at sort of opposite ends of eras.
Yeah.
You know, I was leaving just as streaming was finally blowing up and they were coming out of the doldrums. Mm-hmm. You were there when they were getting really high on CDs, right? Like, is that
exactly? Yeah.
Yeah. So talk about that.
Well, the way I ended up getting at a major was because essentially the the explosion of Nirvana and the indie scene going above ground. Right, that's been the traditional history of everything. The indies have the cool, cutting-edge music. It takes off. The majors gobble it up and burn it out. Then the next scene comes along, and all the indies get bought up. And then, okay, the majors then have to shed all of that extra weight, and then the indies start up again. And it's year after year, right? From punk rock, and then punk rock begat all of the DIY indie labels. And then you started getting little bubbling up with the Husker Du's, and then like the Pixies, and then the big kablam with Nirvana in 91, 92. And so all of those people, all of the majors wanted indie cred, right? And so all of the people I used to work with, or the CMJ also became this monster of a convention, and South by Southwest became this big thing. And it was all essentially graduation to the real money. And that was so every major label had their sort of indie group, right? And I ended up at Atlantic Records, which at the time was being run by Danny Goldberg, who was managing Nirvana, actually simultaneously, I guess. And, that's how I got my foot in the door. Of course, I ended up not really working any of that music. The closest I got to be the product manager for Amphetamine Reptile Records out of Minneapolis, who's their highest profile thing is it generated Helmet. But they had a lot of cool bands that were just too strange for a major label, but they were still coming out anyway, like The Cows and Halo of Flies. But I ended up working with Rush. I worked with the big money that was happening at Atlantic was, Hootie and the Blowfish, Stone Temple Pilots were their big cool band, I'm doing air quotes, but I got to tell you, quick side note here. At the time, right, it was like, oh my gosh, Stone Temple Pilots, they kind of sound like Pearl Jam, and I don't even like Pearl Jam very much, and they sound like every other grunge band. But in retrospect, they have really good songs.
I'm 100% there with you, and I was about to say I'm embarrassed to say that, but it has to be said. You're exactly right. Would you rather be stuck in a room listening to an hour of Stone Temple Pilots or an hour of Pearl Jam? I can make my vote now.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, it's hooky. Yes, it's Zeppelin derivative. It like he has the Eddie Vedder all every now and then, right? It's just like, but at the end of the day, the DeLeo brothers there? Those guys wrote great hooky songs. So anyway,
one thing I would also say in their favor is it's something. Soundgarden has this similar trait, which is at least every record doesn't sound exactly the same.
Yeah.
Like or hate what they do or how they evolved, at least they change.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the whole everything sounds the same. I think is kind of a tough argument, just because I think it all sounds the same unless you're deep in anything, like unless it's a real radical departure, right? It's still frequently it's the same humans, so the voices kind of simply sound the same. It's the same, you have your aesthetic. There's some obviously people who are radically different, but I always find that it's a double-edged sword in that, like, boy, this record, I really like the last one. This one sucks because it's so different. But then it's like, oh, I like this band because they made something different that I really like too. There's only so many Radioheads in the world,
Well, that's where I think, all right, this is where we'll break the fourth wall for a second. This is where we have to be careful, because I think we could start the, I have probably four artists I want to just bring up right now and shit talk with you. I know. And I don't know if that's good for either.
No, I don't even know whether even shit talking Pearl Jam. It's like, I have a lot of people whose tastes I really respect, and it's one of those, Pearl Jam. I don't know. I think they also could be sort of like a Grateful Dead of that generation too. There's people like, I know total Deadheads love that music, who I love every single record in their collection. And it's I don't have a hatred. It just, the magic doesn't happen for me. I've grown old enough now to just feel like, wow, I'm missing out on that pleasure, as opposed to what the fuck's your problem?
Yeah. I chalk it up to like, I can't like everything. There's plenty of music out there and it's not all for me, or I might not have gotten to it, or, are there any good bands that start with the letter P?
The Pixies.
The Pixies.
Yeah. PJ Harvey.
Okay.
Yeah. Pink Floyd.
Pink Floyd. Okay. All right. Because I could think of a lot of bad ones.
Sure. Sure. I mean, I can't discriminate against letters.
No, that's fair. You're more open-minded than I am in that regard.
I'm trying to think of my P-Funk. How about P-Funk?
Does P-Funk? That count?
Parliament Funkadelic.
Yep, yep. I would give you Pavement.
Iggy Pop. I'm trying to think of the P's in my record collection.
In my record collection, I organize by first name. So Iggy's under I.
I haven't gone there yet, but my apps make me. So
that's why I did it. I just wanted everything to be consistent.
Yeah. But do you, just going down that nerd route, do you put your Beatles solo records separately or do you put them as part of your Beatles collection?
No, everything's separate by artist.
See, I have my Stooges and Iggy Pop together. I've gotten very close to alphabetizing by year.
I experimented with things like that when I was younger. The problem is, honestly, the problem I have is whenever I come up with any kind of like system like that, the less obvious it is, I just lose shit then. I'm like, where would George Harrison be? And it would never occur to me that he's under the Beatles.
So psychologically, I think the reason I put the Beatles solo records next to the Beatles is that justifies why I own them.
Well, you know what I mean? You're the person that I learned from, though, that to make the perfect Beatles albums, you take the Paul songs off of them.
I've been warming up to that a little bit. It is true. But that was a CD lesson where you're like,
it was the White Album.
Yeah. Yeah. You take them, you drop them. And yeah,
it's especially egregious with the White Album. I would say I don't necessarily agree with that approach for a lot of the other records, but definitely the White Album. Like, that's pretty that's pretty good. All right. So let's revisit some of our previous discussions, which is who at this point is not in the Hall of Fame that should be.
My first go-to is always Paul Revere and the Raiders on that one.
And what's the argument?
Paul Revere and the Raiders were essentially, they did the first version of Louie Louie. They were like 2 or 3 years ahead. Like they were pre-Beatles, but they were also post-Beatles. So they're the ones... they actually self-promoted themselves. I want to say they're originally like from Idaho, but they were considered sort of like a Northwest band. So they kind of pulled up that whole scene too. And then they had a ton of great singles too. They also hosted their own TV show, Where the Action Is. There's about half a dozen songs that I think are killer. Like, Kicks, Good Thing Going. Like there's, they did the original Stepping Stone.
And why aren't they in?
I just think it's just a rock critic thing. I think it's one of those things. I think they're, it's kind of like the Baseball Hall of Fame. It's like, sorry, you can't be on the ballot anymore. Your time has come and went. Like, did Deep Purple ever get in? Like,
I thought you were going to say Deep Purple. Did they get in? I don't know. I kind of honestly, once it got to like the 90s band started getting in, it became too much for me. Like I think we would argue about it in the last era where it was fun to argue about. Now it's not, I don't want to argue about whether Green Day belongs in the Hall of Fame or not. Exhausting to me.
And that's what I was going to say. I was like, this conversation isn't fun anymore because it's exactly that. Because also it's not... I feel like the powers that be always kind of skip a generation. So it's like the people who are on the board are a little older than us, right? And so they saw the 50s and the 60s one way, and the 70s was a little tired and like they're not as interested in that. Like then it becomes much more about the money in the 70s, right? So who are the younger people that are going to be on the board? Like, where does it go next? Like, are you and I going to get on the board? I think we're going to be passed over. I think it's actually going to go younger, and it's going to be the people that are all about, you know, Pearl Jam and Green Day, like the 90s people, right? And like, at the same time, I feel like that's when I was in the industry, was like kind of like that was my record label days, where it was essentially the 90s. And so to a certain extent, I think that's the worst view to have of who to go in the Hall of Fame. It should always be fan-centric. Right. And I think that's where it's it's not like, oh, we got to get so and so. That was like the best press junket we ever went on, you know, and like, because, but I don't know, Big Star aren't in and they're beloved, but I don't know. To me, that's it. That's very much a critical choice. And the people who know that record love them, and it's important to them. And they started 1,000 bands, but, you know, Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers, like, but the Velvet Underground got in because I think they got marketed well enough to get to a certain pro. So there's just too many factors I don't like to make this a valuable Hall of Fame for me personally. I mean,
yeah, Big Star is a tough one to justify leaving out, given how rediscovered they became. And I mean, it's hard to argue against them.
Well, the fact that no one knows who they are from really, if you walk down the street, what, like 1 in 50? I guess it depends on what neighborhood you are in Brooklyn. I guess,
exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, I think, but to your point about it being for the fans, I think then one of the most justified additions is Dave Clark. I think Dave Clark's an interesting one because, again, 1 in 50 people, like, who the hell knows who Dave Clark is at this point? But Dave Clark belongs in the Hall of Fame.
Is the Dave Clark Five not in?
They're in. I was there. I saw Tom Hanks inducted them, and it was a beautiful speech. Yeah, it was great.
But once again, I just think that would never, if they weren't in already, they would never get in. I think it just passes, that wave kind of passes. By the way, speaking of Tom Hanks, he did for his like 60th birthday, he hosted a thing on Boss. I think it's called like Boss Radio. It's an internet radio. And he DJed, and it was so friggin' good. Like, he goes so deep. It was all like surf bands. It was all, his big thing was like, this was the, you know, New Jersey's answer to the Beatles. This is Wisconsin's answer to it. So it was all like stuff from 64 that I've never heard of before. And I go pretty deep.
Yeah.
And it was all, you know, it sounded familiar, but I was just so happy to hear what a deep fan he is. And that I have this, I had a sort of secret fantasy that he just dusted off his old 45s and like pulled them out, that he's been hanging around since Cleveland from, you know, 60 years ago. But, if nothing else, he might have just picked it all up from doing research from that thing you do. But
no, his induction speech for Dave Clark Five was like, it was clear he was a nerd, and it was clear how much that meant to him as like a kid in his room with his radio.
Yeah.
But that same night, the Ventures got in. So speaking of, that was a good class.
That's a great class.
Yeah. It's also when Madonna got in, and instead of performing, she had the Stooges play. Yeah. That was that's still a peak. Yeah. Peak moment. Seeing Iggy sing Ray of Light was like, that's so great. All right. So let me ask you another Hall of Fame question, then we'll stop. It seems like the 80s was largely passed over. Is there anybody from the 80s that should have made it?
Well, this comes to the whole thing. It's like, not like, should Black Flag be in? Should Husker Du be in? Should Sonic Youth be in? Like these, I mean,
but should they not be in? Like, should, I mean, how do you not have Sonic Youth in?
Well, that's the thing, is it because Sonic Youth was like the band that then, like, right? There's essentially no Nirvana. There's no, right? They were the signing at DGC Geffen that lured all the cool bands over there, right? That was, it's like, oh, they, it was, right? REM and Sonic Youth almost are exactly the same in every way in their importance to the industry, but REM sold a lot more records, right? Because my process is, Black Flag went around and called every pizzeria and showed up and played every garage. Like, there were no venues, and they created venues and created this whole network of places to play. They would play everywhere. REM then went around and found out where Black Flag had played, and they went out and played all of those venues. And at the same time, they were connected to IRS that had built that whole circuit that evolved into really kind of modern booking, right? And so then REM was the first to sign to a major, and had some success. And that kind of paved the way for it. It was okay for Husker Du, and remember, because REM was actually putting all these bands as opening acts. And then Sonic Youth kind of became the stranger band to get signed, but you could see the strategy there. But all of those bands, to me, those are all like major dominoes that there is no something for it. I think Black Flag gets short shifted because they were signed to MCA Records. They were going to put out something on what's called Unicorn Records. And then just before it was about to come out, the president of the company or someone heard it and called it an anti-parent record, and there was no way a company he was going to put this out, and got and that and SST Records came out of the fact that Greg Ginn had SST Records or SST solid state transistors because he was a ham radio nerd. And he had some patents, and he started, and he sold ham radio things. And he's like, well, I guess I got to start a record label for my thing. So it became SST Records too.
That's amazing.
So, yeah. And so that was, so these are people who really like invented the business just out of, you know, the mother of necessity kind of thing. And so more so than anybody, Black Flag really, except Black Flag has also a bad problem where there was, you know, a lot of violence at their shows and, you know, and some of it was racist crap and like not of their own generation of generating it, but it's just that bad, you know, Nazi skinhead thing kind of, you know, and it was anti-police and all, right? But so I could see where that, but it's like, if then the Sex Pistols shouldn't be in, then the
Rolling Stones shouldn't be in.
Yeah.
Because I heard, there was a lot of violence at their shows for 2 or 3 years.
That's true. Or Elvis Presley or Bill Haley in the Comets.
Yeah.
You know, there's pool cues there.
Am I missing something by having not stuck with REM throughout their entire catalog?
They put out a lot of records. They're of a certain taste. Like, I, you know, when they first came out, I was very excited about them. I actually liked their last couple of records.
That's what I'm asking. Yeah. Did I, by not sticking with them through the 90s and into the early 2000s, am I shortchanging myself?
It's funny. I can't point to like, oh, this record's great. I enjoy listening to them, but I can't say I also pull them out that often either. But the last couple ones where they kind of didn't care and had the big Warner deal and you know, they made some, you know, it was interesting.
I admire that about them. You know, that they just that fact, it's almost like I don't need to hear the music. I love what they did with the money.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, and they're apparently fantastic citizens of Athens, Georgia. Like they're good civil citizens. And Michael Stipe in particular, I think, is like, he gets involved in local politics and does good things with his money. It's, I mean, yeah, I mean,
yeah. It's funny. I don't listen to them regularly, but I, every year or so I go back and I just kind of go through mainly, you know, the stuff through, I guess, through Green. Like I'll listen to the 80s hits and the early singles and am reminded by how amazing that stuff is.
Yeah. No, they were great. They were great. Well, first time I saw them, they were the opening act for the English Beat at a chapel at Oberlin College in Ohio, and I the Murmur came out like the next Friday or something. So this was just before Murmur came out, and I snagged the set list, and I still have the set list framed in my office. So it was like the first time they were like playing those songs. A lot of songs, yeah. So and the English Beat were pretty great too.
Yeah, I bet. Have you seen any shows since COVID has, I don't know, evolved into something that only kills dumb people?
I haven't. My first show, so the first show I ended up buying tickets to is, I'm going to go see Devo at Radio City Music Hall in September. But before that, I'm now going to, as shows sort of started setting up, there's a band that I really like called Bodega. From here in Brooklyn that are playing at Baby's All Right, the club here. And I think I want to say it's like the 2nd of September. It's like that Friday. So that'll probably be the first live show I go to. So yeah, also actually end of September also got, Sturgill, I'm blanking on his name now because I'm on the radio. Sturgill Simpson. He's playing Webster Hall.
Yeah, he's fine without our promotion.
Exactly. But it was like, he's, you know, the whole interesting thing is that, like, you know, he's doing four nights. I'm always impressed, and I learned a lot of this from you, is that the fact that when people underplay, like, it's like they're thinking about their careers, like they're thinking about their fans, they underplay their markets, they don't, and he's not doing it like it's Webster Hall and $5,000 tickets. It's still, you know, whatever, $50 ticket. So it's just,
you can play the Garden at this point, right? Easily.
Probably a couple nights.
Yeah, I would think.
Yeah,
at
$95 or $120 or whatever. Especially people are so jonesing to go to shows, right? Yeah, all of the shows they didn't go to last year that they hang on to tickets for because they want the show to happen. Like, don't give me my money back. I want to stay at the show. I want to go.
Yeah. Did you happen to hear the episode that I did with Gerald from Devo?
No, I didn't. So
it was in the spring when they were kind of campaigning for the Hall of Fame.
Oh, uh-huh. Yeah.
And their case is strong, first of all. Devo's Absolutely. Case for the Hall of Fame Absolutely. Is strong. But I was taken by how much it means to them. Like, they actually, in a very heartfelt, genuine way, they want to be in the Hall of Fame. Like, I was kind of surprised that it was important.
Yeah.
But they felt like, you know, there's a place for us there. We should be there. And they're not.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they were on this ballot. They still haven't gotten it. I've kind of stopped paying. Like, I see the ballot and then I'm not quite sure who actually gets in or not. But I know they were on the final ballot, right?
They were on the ballot. Yeah.
But they didn't get in?
They didn't get in.
With Kraftwerk too, right?
Yeah. And you would think, like, the two of them together, it makes total sense.
Yeah. No, I love the Devo. The more I know about their history, the more, like, it's almost, it just makes them funnier. Like, the fact that they're just, they make this goofball music, but it was so subversive. And it came out of such subversive roots. And it really, like, they were totally goofing on fucking with the man. Like it was genius. And that's why I could see maybe that is their ultimate, like, I'm going to get into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I'm like, the seed was Kent State. I mean, it's amazing. I don't know. Yeah.
They're another band. Like, if you give them money, they're going to do something fucking goofy with it. They're going to make some kind of statement with it, and they're going to bite the hand that feeds them. And that's probably, I hate to say it, but that's probably what's keeping them out. There's somebody with a long memory that says, why are you making fun of our high art form? Rock and roll.
I shy away from the conspiracy that someone has that kind of power, but this comes back to, though, you know, if we go back to Rolling Stone was definitely being taken the piss out of during that period. So even, you know, they warmed up to the Clash, you know, but originally the first review of the Clash was the Clash arrive in America and open with I'm So Bored with the USA and go back immediately. Right. It was like total dismissal of, like, this is not high art. Like,
who are these people?
Disco album, you know?
Yeah. You know? All right.
We are far away from the deep legalesque beginning of this show.
No, that's how it's supposed to be. That's how the best conversations on this podcast. I mean, really, the podcast is just about me talking to interesting people about things that me and very few other people care about. So that's, like, it's amazing.
Well, you know, we could do that for hours. So.
Thank you, John Rosso and the team at Harry Fox Agency. Thank you, Aunt Taylor and the team at Light. And as always, thank you for listening to Spotlight On. Get and share all of our past episodes, write a review, and even send us a message through our website, spotlightonpodcast.com. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, be safe and stay in touch.